Hello?
What's that? Slowly, with the grace of a beautiful woman stepping into a bath, a long, slim, silver craft lowered itself gently to the ground. Soft light streamed from it. From its opening doorway stepped a tall, elegant creature with a curiously fine grey-green complexion. It walked slowly towards them. In its path lay the dark figure of a peasant who had been crying quietly to himself since he had watched his liver being eaten by Ogdai's dog, and had known that no way was he going to get it back, and wondering how on earth his poor wife was going to cope now. He chose this moment finally to pass on to better things. The tall alien stepped over him with distaste, and though you would have had to read his face very closely to realize this, a little envy. He nodded briefly to each of the gathered Mongol leaders in turn, and pulled a small clipboard out from under his heavy, metallic robe.
"Good evening," it said in a small, weaselly voice. "My name is Wowbagger, also called the Infinitely Prolonged. I shall not trouble you with the reasons why. Greetings."
He turned and addressed the completely pop-eyed Mighty Khan.
"You are Genghis Khan. Genghis Temujin Khan, son of Yasugai."
The diary scroll slipped from Khan's hands to the ground. The pale luminescence from Wowbagger's ship suffused his wondering, ravaged, careworn yellow features. As in a dream, the mighty emperor stepped forward in acknowledgement.
"Can I just check the spelling?" said the alien, showing him the clipboard. "I would hate to get it wrong at this stage and then have to start all over again. I really would."
Khan nodded faintly.
"Right number of H's, then," said the alien.
Again the transfigured emperor slightly inclined his face, while his eyes still boggled.
"Good,"
said Wowbagger, and made a little tick on his clipboard. He looked up.
"Genghis Khan," he said, "you are a wanker. You are a tosspot. You are a very tiny piece of turd. Thank you."
With that, he retreated into his ship and flew off. There was a nasty kind of silence. Later that year, Genghis Khan stormed into Europe in such a rage that he almost forgot to burn down Asia before he left. From the utterly, utterly merry comic relief, Christmas Book, 1986. Young Zaphod plays it safe. A large flying craft moved swiftly across the surface of an astoundingly beautiful sea. From mid-morning onwards it plied back and forth in great, widening arcs, and at last attracted the attention of the local islanders, a peaceful, seafood-loving people who gathered on the beach and squinted up into the blinding sun, trying to see what was there. Any sophisticated, knowledgeable person who had knocked about, seen a few things, would probably have remarked on how much the craft looked like a filing cabinet. A large and recently burgled filing cabinet lying on its back with its drawers in the air and flying. The islanders, whose experience was of a different kind, were instead struck by how little it looked like a lobster. They chattered excitedly about its total lack of claws, its stiff, unbendy back, and the fact that it seemed to experience the greatest difficulty staying on the ground. This last feature seemed particularly funny to them. They jumped up and down on the spot a lot to demonstrate to the stupid thing that they themselves found staying on the ground the easiest thing in the world. But soon this entertainment began to pall for them. After all, since it was perfectly clear to them that the thing was not a lobster, and since their world was blessed with an abundance of things that were lobsters, a good half a dozen of which were now marching succulently up the beach towards them, they saw no reason to waste any more time on the thing, but decided instead to adjourn immediately for a late lobster lunch. At that exact moment, the craft stopped suddenly in mid-air, then upended itself and plunged headlong into the ocean with a great crash of spray which sent them shouting into the trees. When they re-emerged, nervously, a few minutes later, all they were able to see was a smoothly scarred circle of water and a few gulping bubbles. "That's odd," they said to each other, between mouthfuls of the best lobster to be had anywhere in the Western Galaxy. "That's the second time that's happened in a year." The craft, which wasn't a lobster, dived direct to a depth of 200 feet and hung there in the heavy blueness while vast masses of water swayed about it. High above, where the water was magically clear, a brilliant formation of fish flashed away. Below, where the light had difficulty reaching, the colour of the water sank to a dark and savage blue. Here, at 200 feet, the sun streamed feebly.
A large, silk-skinned sea mammal rolled idly by, inspecting the craft with a kind of half-interest, as if it had half-expected to find something of this kind round about here. And then it slid on up and away towards the rippling light. The craft waited here a minute or two, taking readings, and then descended another 200 feet. At this depth, it was becoming seriously dark. After a moment or two, the internal lights of the craft shut down, and in the second or so that passed before the main external beam suddenly stabbed out, the only visible light came from a small, hazily illuminated pink sign, which read, "The Beeblebrocks Salvage and Really Wild Stuff Corporation." The huge beams switched downwards, catching a vast shoal of silver fish, which swiveled away in silent panic. In the dim control room, which extended in a broad bow from the craft's blunt prow, four heads were gathered around a computer display that was analysing the very, very faint and intermittent signals that were emanating from deep on the seabed. "That's it," said the owner of one of the heads finally.
"Can we be quite sure?" said the owner of another of the heads.
100% positive," replied the owner of the first head.
"You're 100% positive that the ship which is crashed on the bottom of this ocean is the ship which you said you were 100% positive could 100% positively never crash," said the owner of the two remaining heads. "Hey," he put up two of his hands, "I'm only asking."
The two officials from the Safety and Civil Reassurance Administration responded to this with a very cold stare, but the man with the odd, or rather the even, number of heads missed it. He flung himself back on the pilot couch, opened a couple of beers, one for himself, and the other also for himself, stuck his feet on the console and said, "Hey, baby," through the ultra-glass at a passing fish.
"Mr. Beeblebrocks," began the shorter and less reassuring of the two officials, in a low voice.
"Yep," said Zaphod, rapping a suddenly empty can down on some of the more sensitive instruments.
"You ready to dive? Let's go." "Mr. Beeblebrocks, let us make one thing perfectly clear."
"Yeah, let's," said Zaphod. "How about this for a start? Why don't you just tell me what's really on this ship?"
"We have told you," said the official. "Byproducts."
Zaphod exchanged weary glances with himself.
"Byproducts," he said. "Byproducts of what?"
"Processes," said the official.
"What processes?"
"Processes that are perfectly safe."
"Santa Zaquana Vustra!" exclaimed both of Zaphod's heads in chorus. "So safe that you have to build a zarking fortress ship to take the byproducts to the nearest black hole and tip them in? Only it doesn't get there because the pilot does a detour. Is this right, to pick up some lobster? Okay, so the guy is cool, but, I mean, own up. This is barking time. This is major lunch. This is stool approaching critical mass. This is a total vocabulary failure."
"Shut up,"
his right head yelled at his left. "We're flanging." He got a good calming grip on the remaining beer can.
"Listen, guys," he resumed after a moment's peace and contemplation.
The two officials had said nothing. Conversation at this level was not something to which they felt they could aspire.
"I just want to know," insisted Zaphod, "what you're getting me into here."
He stabbed a finger at the intermittent readings trickling over the computer screen. They meant nothing to him, but he didn't like the look of them at all. They were all squiggly with lots of long numbers and things.
"It's breaking up, is that it?" he shouted. "It's got a hole full of epsilonic radiating aerist rods, or something that'll fry this whole space sector for zillions of years back, and it's breaking up. Is that the story? Is that what we're going down to find? Am I going to come out of that wreck with even more heads?"
"It cannot possibly be a wreck, Mr. Beeblebrocks," insisted the official. "The ship is guaranteed to be perfectly safe. It cannot possibly break up."
"Then why are you so keen to go and look at it?"
"We like to look at things that are perfectly safe."
"Free-yo!"
"Mr. Beeblebrocks," said the official patiently, "may I remind you that you have a job to do?"
"Yeah? Well, maybe I don't feel so keen on doing it all of a sudden. What do you think I am, completely without any moral what's-its? What do they call those moral things?"
"Scruples."
"Scruples, thank you. Whatsoever?"
Well? The two officials waited calmly. They coughed slightly to help pass the time. Zaphod sighed a what-is-the-world-coming-to sort of sigh to absolve himself from all blame, and swung himself around in his seat.
Ship? He called.
Yup, said the ship.
Do what I do.
The ship thought about this for a few milliseconds, and then, after double-checking all the seals on its heavy-duty bulkheads, it began slowly, inexorably, in the hazy blaze of its lights, to sink to the lowest depths. 500 feet. 1,000. 2,000. Here, at a pressure of nearly 70 atmospheres, in the chilling depths where no light reaches, nature keeps its most heated imaginings. 2 foot-long nightmares loomed wildly into the bleaching light, yawned and vanished into the blackness. 2,500 feet. At the dim edges of the ship's lights, guilty secrets flitted by with their eyes on stalks. Gradually, the topography of the distantly approaching ocean bed resolved with greater and greater clarity on the computer displays, until at last a shape could be made out that was separate and distinct from its surroundings. It was like a huge, lopsided cylindrical fortress, which widened sharply halfway along its length to accommodate the heavy ultraplating with which the crucial storage holds were clad, and which were supposed by its builders to have made this the most secure and impregnable spaceship ever built. Before launch, the material structure of this section had been battered, rammed, blasted, and subjected to every assault its builders knew it could withstand, in order to demonstrate that it could withstand them. The tense silence in the cockpit tightened perceptibly, as it became clear that it was this section that had broken rather neatly in two.
In fact, it's perfectly safe, said one of the officials. It's built so that even if the ship does break up, the storage holds cannot possibly be breached.
3,825 feet. 4 high-pressure A smart suits moved slowly out of the open hatchway of the salvage craft and waded through the barrage of its lights towards the monstrous shape that loomed darkly out of the sea night. They moved with a sort of clumsy grace, near weightless, though weighed on by a world of water. With his right-hand head, Zaphod peered up into the black immensities above him, and for a moment his mind sang with a silent roar of horror. He glanced to his left, and was relieved to see that his other head was busy watching the Brockian ultra-cricket broadcasts on the helmet vid without concern. Slightly behind him, to his left, walked the two officials from the Safety and Civil Reassurance Administration. Slightly in front of him, to his right, walked the empty suit, carrying their implements and testing the way for them. They passed the huge rift in the broken-backed Starship billion-year bunker and played their flashlights up into it. Mangled machinery loomed between torn and twisted bulkheads, 2 feet thick. A family of large transparent eels lived in there now and seemed to like it. The empty suit preceded them along the length of the ship's gigantic, murky hull, trying the airlocks. The third one it tested ground open uneasily. They crowded inside it, and waited several long minutes while the pump mechanisms dealt with the hideous pressure that the ocean exerted, and slowly replaced it with an equally hideous pressure of air and inert gases. At last the inner door slid open, and they were admitted to a dark outer holding area of the Starship billion-year bunker. Several more high-security Titan O hold doors had to be passed through, each of which the officials opened with a selection of quark keys. Soon they were so deep within the heavy security fields that the ultra-cricket broadcasts were beginning to fade, and Zaphod had to switch to one of the rock video stations, since there was nowhere that they were not able to reach. A final doorway slid open, and they emerged into a large sepulchral space. Zaphod played his flashlight against the opposite wall, and it fell full on a wild-eyed, screaming face. Zaphod screamed a diminished fifth himself, dropped his light and sat heavily on the floor, or rather on a body which had been lying there undisturbed for around 6 months, and which reacted to being sat on by exploding with great violence. Zaphod wondered what to do about all this, and after a brief but hectic internal debate, decided that passing out would be the very thing. He came to a few minutes later, and pretended not to know who he was, where he was, or how he had got there, but was not able to convince anybody. He then pretended that his memory suddenly returned with a rush, and that the shock caused him to pass out again,
but he was helped unwillingly to his feet by the empty suit, which he was beginning to take a serious dislike to, and forced to come to terms with his surroundings. They were dimly and fitfully lit, and unpleasant in a number of respects, the most obvious of which was the colourful arrangement of parts of the ship's late lamented navigation officer over the floor, walls and ceiling, and especially over the lower half of his, Zaphod's, suit. The effect of this was so astoundingly nasty that we shall not be referring to it again at any point in this narrative, other than to record briefly the fact that it caused Zaphod to throw up inside his suit, which he therefore removed and swapped after suitable headgear modifications with the empty one. Unfortunately, the stench of the fetid air in the ship, followed by the sight of his own suit walking around casually draped in rotting intestines, was enough to make him throw up in the other suit as well, which was a problem that he and the suit would simply have to live with. There. All done. No more nastiness. At least, no more of that particular nastiness. The owner of the screaming face had calmed down very slightly now, and was bubbling away incoherently in a large tank of yellow liquid, an emergency suspension tank.
"It was crazy," he babbled. "Crazy. I told him we could always try the lobster on the way back, but he was crazy, obsessed. Did you ever get like that about lobster? Because I don't. Seems to me it's all rubbery and fiddly to eat and not that much taste. Well, I mean, is there? I infinitely prefer scallops and said so. Oh, Zarquan, I said so."
Zaphod stared at this extraordinary apparition flailing in its tank. The man was attached to all kinds of life support tubes, and his voice was bubbling out of speakers that echoed insanely round the ship, returning as haunting echoes from deep and distant corridors.
"That was where I went wrong," the madman yelled. "I actually said that I preferred scallops, and he said it was because I hadn't had real lobster like they did where his ancestors came from, which was here, and he'd prove it. He said it was no problem. He said the lobster here was worth a whole journey, let alone the small diversion it would take to get here, and he swore he could handle the ship in the atmosphere, but it was madness. Madness!"
He screamed and paused with his eyes rolling, as if the word had rung some kind of bell in his mind.
"The ship went right out of control. I couldn't believe what we were doing. And just to prove a point about lobster, which is really so overrated as a food, I'm sorry to go on about lobsters so much. I'll try and stop in a minute. But they've been on my mind so much for the months I've been in this tank. Can you imagine what it's like to be stuck in a ship with the same guys for months, eating junk food, when all one guy will talk about is lobster, and then spend 6 months floating by yourself in a tank thinking about it? I promise I will try and shut up about the lobster. I really will. Lobsters, 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 enough. I think I'm the only survivor. I'm the only one who managed to get to an emergency tank before we went down. I sent out the Mayday and then we hit. It's a disaster, isn't it? A total disaster. And all because the guy liked lobsters. How much sense am I making? It's really hard for me to tell."
He gazed at them beseechingly, and his mind seemed to sway slowly back down to earth like a falling leaf. He blinked and looked at them oddly, like a monkey peering at a strange fish. He scrabbled curiously with his wrinkled-up fingers at the glass side of the tank. Tiny, thick yellow bubbles loosed themselves from his mouth and nose, caught briefly in his swab of hair and strayed on upwards.
"Oh, Zarquan! Oh, heavens!"
he mumbled pathetically to himself.
"I've been found! I've been rescued!"
"Well," said one of the officials briskly, "you've been found at least."
He strode over to the main computer bank in the middle of the chamber and started checking quickly through the ship's main monitor circuits for damage reports.
"The aerist rod chambers are intact," he said.
"Holy dingoes, doos," snarled Zaphod. "There are aerist rods on board."
Aerist rods were devices used in a now happily abandoned form of energy production. When the hunt for new sources of energy had at one point got particularly frantic, one bright young chap suddenly spotted that one place which had never used up all its available energy was the past. And with the sudden rush of blood to the head that such insights tend to induce, he invented a way of mining it that very same night. And within a year, huge tracts of the past were being drained of all their energy and simply wasting away. Those who claimed that the past should be left unspoilt were accused of indulging in an extremely expensive form of sentimentality. The past provided a very cheap, plentiful, and clean source of energy. There could always be a few natural past reserves set up if anyone wanted to pay for their upkeep, and as for the claim that draining the past impoverished the present, well, maybe it did, slightly. But the effects were immeasurable, and you really had to keep a sense of proportion.
It was only when it was realized that the present really was being impoverished, and that the reason for it was that those selfish, plundering, wastrel bastards up in the future were doing exactly the same thing, that everyone realized that every single aerist rod and the terrible secret of how they were made would have to be utterly and forever destroyed. They claimed it was for the sake of their grandparents and grandchildren, but it was, of course, for the sake of their grandparents' grandchildren and their grandchildren's grandparents. The official from the Safety and Civil Reassurance Administration gave a dismissive shrug. "They're perfectly safe," he said. He glanced up at Zaphod and suddenly said with uncharacteristic frankness, "There's worse than that on board. At least," he added, tapping at one of the computer screens, "I hope it's on board." The other official rounded on him sharply.
"What the hell do you think you're saying?"
he snapped. The first shrugged again. He said, "It doesn't matter. He can say what he likes. No one would believe him. It's why we chose to use him rather than anything official, isn't it? The more wild the story he tells, the more it'll sound like he's some hippie adventurer making it up. He can even say that we said this, and it'll make him sound like a paranoid." He smiled pleasantly at Zaphod, who was seething in a suit full of sick.
"You may accompany us," he told him, "if you wish." "You see," said the official, examining the ultra-titanium outer seals of the aerist rod hold. "Perfectly secure, perfectly safe."
He said the same thing as they passed holds containing chemical weapons so powerful that a teaspoonful could fatally infect an entire planet. He said the same thing as they passed holds containing zeta-active compounds so powerful that a teaspoonful could blow up a whole planet. He said the same thing as they passed holds containing theta-active compounds so powerful that a teaspoonful could irradiate a whole planet.
"I'm glad I'm not a planet," muttered Zaphod.
"You'd have nothing to fear," assured the official from the Safety and Civil Reassurance Administration. "Planets are very safe, provided," he added, and paused.
They were approaching the hold nearest to the point where the back of the starship billion-year bunker was broken. The corridor here was twisted and deformed, and the floor was damp and sticky in patches.
"Ho hum," he said. "Ho very much hum."
"Oh, what's in this hold?" demanded Zaphod.
"By-products," said the official, clamming up again.
"By-products," insisted Zaphod quietly. "Of what?"
Neither official answered. Instead, they examined the hold door very carefully and saw that its seals were twisted apart by the forces that had deformed the whole corridor. One of them touched the door slightly. It swung open to his touch. There was darkness inside, with just a couple of dim yellow lights deep within it.
"Of what?" hissed Zaphod.
The leading official turned to the other.
"There's an escape capsule," he said, "that the crew were to use to abandon ship before jettisoning it into the black hole," he said. "I think it would be good to know that it's still there."
The other official nodded and left without a word. The first official quietly beckoned Zaphod in. The large dim yellow lights glowed about 20 feet from them.
"The reason," he said quietly, "why everything else in this ship is, I maintain, safe, is that no one is really crazy enough to use them. No one. At least, no one that crazy would ever get near them. Anyone that mad or dangerous ring very deep alarm bells. People may be stupid, but they're not that stupid."
"By-products," hissed Zaphod again. He had to hiss in order that his voice shouldn't be heard to tremble. "Of what?"
Designer people."
"What?"
"The Sirius Cybernetics Corporation were awarded a huge research grant to design and produce synthetic personalities to order. The results were uniformly disastrous. All the people and personalities turned out to be amalgams of characteristics which simply could not coexist in naturally occurring life forms. Most of them were just poor, pathetic misfits. But some were deeply, deeply dangerous. Dangerous because they didn't ring alarm bells in other people. They could walk through situations the way that ghosts walk through walls, because no one spotted the danger. The most dangerous of all were three identical ones. They were put in this hold to be blasted with this ship right out of this universe. They are not evil. In fact, they are rather simple and charming.
but they are the most dangerous creatures that ever lived, because there is nothing they will not do, if allowed, and nothing they will not be allowed to do.
Zaphod looked at the dim yellow lights, the two dim yellow lights. As his eyes became accustomed to the light, he saw that the two lights framed a third space where something was broken. Wet, sticky patches gleamed dully on the floor. Zaphod and the official walked cautiously towards the lights. At that moment, four words came crashing into the helmet headsets from the other official.
"The capsule has gone," he said tersely.
"Trace it," snapped Zaphod's companion. "Find exactly where it has gone. We must know where it has gone."
Zaphod approached the two remaining tanks. A quick glance showed him that each contained an identical floating body. He examined one more carefully. The body, that of an elderly man, was floating in a thick yellow liquid. The man was kindly looking, with lots of pleasant laugh lines round his face. His hair seemed unnaturally thick and dark for someone of his age, and his right hand seemed continually to be weaving forward and back, up and down, as if shaking hands with an endless succession of unseen ghosts. He smiled genially, babbled and burbled like a half-sleeping baby, and occasionally seemed to rock very slightly with little tremors of laughter, as if he had just told himself a joke he hadn't heard before, or didn't remember properly. Waving, smiling, chortling, with little yellow bubbles beading on his lips, he seemed to inhabit a distant world of simple dreams. Another terse message suddenly came through his helmet headset. The planet towards which the escape capsule had headed had already been identified. It was in Galactic Sector ZZ9 plural Z Alpha. Zaphod found a small speaker by the tank and turned it on. The man in the yellow liquid babbled gently about a shining city on a hill. He also heard the official from the Safety and Civil Reassurance Administration issue instructions to the effect that the missing escape capsule contained a Reagan, and that the planet in ZZ9 plural Z Alpha must be made perfectly safe. From the Utterly, Utterly Merry Comic Relief Christmas Book, 1986. Excerpts from an interview conducted by Matt Newsom. Douglas. The thing with Dirk was that I felt I had lost contact with that character. I couldn't make that book viable, which is why I said, okay, let's go off and do something else. Then, looking back at all the ideas that were there in Salmon of Doubt, I looked at it again about a year later and suddenly realized what it was that I'd been getting wrong, which was that these are essentially much more like Hitchhiker's ideas and not like Dirk Gently ideas. So there will come a point, I suspect, at some point in the future, where I will write a sixth Hitchhiker book. But I kind of want to do that in an odd kind of way because people have said, quite rightly, that Mostly Harmless is a very bleak book. And it was a bleak book. The reason for that is very simple. I was having a lousy year for all sorts of personal reasons that I don't want to go into. I just had a thoroughly miserable year, and I was trying to write a book against that background, and guess what? It was a rather bleak book. I would love to finish Hitchhiker on a slightly more upbeat note. So 5 seems to be a wrong kind of number. 6 is a better kind of number. I think that a lot of the stuff which was originally in Salmon of Doubt or was planned into Salmon of Doubt and really wasn't working, I think could be yanked out and put together with some new thoughts. Matt Newsom. Yes, because certainly some people have heard that Salmon of Doubt was now going to be a new Hitchhiker book. Douglas. Well, in a sense, because I shall be salvaging some of the ideas I couldn't make work within a Dirk Gently framework and putting them in a Hitchhiker framework, undergoing necessary changes on the way. And for old time's sake, I may call it Salmon of Doubt. I may call it, well, who knows? Editor's note. This version of the Salmon of Doubt has been assembled from various versions of this work in progress. Chapter 1 has been salvaged from an early draft. The rest of the text comes from one continuous body of work, but for the insertion of Chapter 9, Douglas's most recent writing, which seemed to fit best in this penultimate position. Douglas's fax to his long-time London editor has been placed at the end, and it describes his overall scheme for the book, giving us some inkling as to where the story might have gone from there. The Salmon of Doubt. Chapter 1. Early most mornings, Dave climbed up to this isolated spot on the hill and brought small offerings to leave in the shrine of St. Clive, the patron saint of real estate agents. Today, what he'd brought was, so far as he could make out, part of a swimming pool cleaning device,
a sort of large, plastic, sucking, lobsterish thing. He laid the thing down carefully and stood back to admire the effect. The shrine was just a small heap of rocks, really, with a little array of things that had got dug up from time to time. There was a remote-controlled garage opener, something that was probably part of a juice extractor, and a small, illuminated Kermit the Frog. The pool-cleaning lobsterish thing was a pretty good addition, and he arranged it so that its 2 feet of broken-ribbed plastic tubing hung down like an elephant's trunk over Kermit. His morning trips up to the shrine were partly just to amuse himself, but also a chance to be alone and reflect on things. This whole place had started just as somewhere to fool around by himself, but it had rapidly turned into something kind of bigger than he meant, and he needed somewhere to get away from it all and think about things. Sometimes he'd even worry. When he was worried, he would start to giggle slightly, and when he was really worried, he would start to hum old Carpenter's tunes till the worry went away. But today he wasn't going to worry. Today he was going to have fun. He unslung the canvas bag he'd brought with him and dropped it to the ground for a moment. From up here, the view was stupendous. Lush forest surrounded Daveland in every direction. Forest of extraordinary richness and diversity, teeming with life and colour. Through it wound the River Dave, which then meandered on through the hills till it met, 500 miles away, the immense ocean, which, until recently, he had called the Dave Ocean, but which, in a fit of modest embarrassment, he had now renamed the Karen Ocean. He had always thought that Pacific was a really dumb name. He had been on it. It wasn't Pacific at all. He'd fixed that. Dave Land itself was now a pretty impressive affair. Astonishing, really, when he thought about it. He brushed his hand through his lank hair and stared out at it, suppressing a very, very small giggle. Daveland lightly covered about 90 acres of hillside, with new outcrops already beginning to appear on nearby hills. Beautiful homes, much more beautiful than any of the ones that his imaginary St. Clive would have sold or even understood. None of your split-level ranch-style crap with stupid conversation pits that anyone with half a brain would probably kill themselves rather than converse in. Dave's houses were a different kind altogether. Apart from anything else, they were smart houses. Just simple stuff, like they faced the right way. They had glass in the right places, stone in the right places, water in the right places, plants in the right places. So the air moved through them properly and was warm where you wanted it and cool where you wanted it. It was just physics. Most architects didn't know any physics, he decided. They just knew dumb stuff. In Dave's houses, prisms and fibres moved sunlight where you wanted it. Heat exchangers took heat from the food in the fridge and gave it to the food in the oven. Simple. People went into Dave's houses and would say, "Hey, this is really neat. How come other people don't build houses like this?" Answer? Because they're dumb. And telephones. Dave had given people here much neater, smarter, altogether more fabulous telephones than they'd ever had before. Now they wanted television as well, which Dave thought was pretty dumb in the first place, but monumentally dumb in the circumstances. But that, in turn, had been a pretty interesting problem, and Dave, of course, had solved it. But Dave had solved so many problems that he had inadvertently created a new one. Daveland was now a community of nearly 1,000 people, which made him kind of responsible. He hadn't expected to be responsible. He pulled up a bunch of long grass and swished it around fretfully. The early morning sunlight glinted off Dave's place. Dave's place was easily the largest and most gracious of all the buildings in, well, in the world. It ringed the summit of the hill opposite with elegant sweeping white stone walls and seeming acres of glass. The summit itself was laid out as a Japanese garden. Streams ran down through the house from it. Just beneath Dave's place, on the same hillside and contained within the same security compound, he couldn't believe he had to have stuff like security compounds now. And 40 of the 900-plus inhabitants of Daveland were now lawyers. Was the Way of the Nostril. The Way of the Nostril was probably the single smartest thing that Dave had ever thought of. Even he, to whom most things that most people would think were pretty smart were pretty dumb, thought it was pretty smart. It was the single reason that all of this was here. And it had become the single thing that made Dave hum old Carpenter's tunes most. Except, maybe, the lawyers. The sun was now gleaming brilliantly all over Daveland.
It was pretty neat, Dave had to admit, but he also had to admit that he had kind of liked Daveland when it was just his own funny, stupid place to come to because only he was smart enough to get there. But one thing had led to another, and now all this. Here he was, only 25, and already beginning to feel like he was almost 30. Well, screw all that. Today he was going to have some fun. He picked up the large canvas bag and slung it back over his shoulders. Sam would have a fit. The lawyers would go nuts. Good. He turned and climbed further on up the hill. The hill was called Top of the World and was named after the tune by the Carpenters. One of the great things about having your own world was that you could just go ahead and like the Carpenters on it. The hill got pretty rocky and craggy higher up, and Dave had to do a bit of rock scrambling to get to where he was going. Within about 20 minutes he was pretty hot and a bit sweaty, but he'd made it to the top, or at least the last significant flat bit, a solid slab of deeply rutted rock on which he sat and dumped the bag. He gathered his breath for a few moments and then started to unpack. He pulled out aluminum struts, he pulled out orange strings, he pulled out little purple sheets of Kevlar. After about 10 minutes of assembly, the thing was ready. A large, gossamer-winged insect of a contraption. The scraps of Kevlar strung between the struts of the frame were surprisingly small and oddly shaped. Dave had worked out that most of the cloth used in conventional hang gliders was redundant and had got rid of it. He examined the assembled frame systematically and satisfied himself that it was all as it should be, that it was Dave-worthy. He looked out nervously, but only just for a moment. He was going to do it anyway, so it was dumb to be nervous. Carefully picking up the hang glider, he carried it out to the edge of the rock, till he was standing on a ledge looking out over the whole extent of Daveland. He noticed with satisfaction that although his glider looked like nothing more than a kind of drying frame for silk bikinis, it was very stiff, and he had to pull it forcefully through the air to move it. From here to Dave's place was about a mile horizontally and a couple of hundred feet vertically. He could just see, glinting in the sun, his large blue swimming pool, neatly secluded within the Japanese garden on the top of Dave's hill. The distance and the direction of the sun made details a little difficult, but he was confident that Sam would be waiting for him there beside the pool. He glanced at his watch. It was just after 8 o'clock, and he'd scheduled a meeting for 8. Sam would be there. Sam's view was that a lot of Dave's plans and schemes were reckless, crazy, irresponsible, occasionally bordering on the just, plain, dumb. He reckoned he could drop himself pretty neatly into that. That'd be something better than dumb guys could do. How tough could it be to do, if you were Dave? He checked the wind direction, stepped into a lightweight harness belt, tightened it, clipped the belt to the glider, passed his hands through 2 loops, gripped the main struts, and he was ready. All he had to do now was throw himself off into space. Wow. Okay. Go. No fuss, no dumb stuff. With a light heart, he threw himself out, forward, and sailed into empty space. The air supported him immediately with a little rough buffeting. He braced himself against the frame, then tried to relax a little, then relaxed a little more, trying to find a good balance that was easy but responsive. He got it. He was out there. He was flying. He was just some kind of a bird. Hey, this was good. The empty air was a kind of shock, but a good shock, like a swimming pool in the morning. And the air wasn't empty. It was like falling into enormous invisible pillows, with fingers that came out, tugging and pulling at you, ruffling your hair, rattling your T-shirt. As his brain got to grips with the huge openness around him, he felt like a little toy hanging from the end of an immense mobile, slowly turning over Dave World. He was turning in a big, easy arc. A little bit to the right, and then, in response to a small shift in his weight, a little bit to the left. But still, it seemed, moving as an arc within an arc, a wheel within a wheel. The world, his world, turned slowly around beneath him. Green, rich, lush, and vivid. It was about 1.2 million years since the human race had suddenly gone extinct, and the world had really perked up a lot in that time. In geological terms, it was but a fleeting moment, of course, but the forces of evolution had suddenly had tons of space to play in, huge gaps to fill, and everything had started to thrive like crazy. Everybody used to talk about saving the world. Well, Dave had done it. Now it was great. The whole place was really neat now. Dave World. Yay! He was riding the air pretty well now, not fighting it, but flowing along it. He was beginning to get a sense, though, that just dropping himself in his own swimming pool might be a little tougher than he had expected. But that was how he liked things to be, a little tougher than he expected. Maybe it was even going to be a lot tougher, he began to realise. It was one thing to be staying comfortably aloft, following the currents riding gradually down. It was quite another thing to steer in any meaningful kind of way. When he tried to turn too sharply, the delicate structure around him would start to rattle and bang in quite an alarming way.
End of side 5A.